As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a growing network of people who believe the center of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ, and that learning to take love seriously is vital for how we practice discipleship, mission, and leadership. The Gravity Leadership Podcast explores, in practical ways, how to root our lives and our leadership in this love that holds all of us and everything together.
Ben, welcome.
Welcome to you, Matt.
Well, thanks, but you're in my house.
Welcome to your house and your room. I just showed up here about half an hour ago, and welcome.
Ben, do you know why? Do you have a question for you? Do you know why we thought starting Gravity was such a good idea?
I think I do, but this feels like a setup for a joke.
This is like the pastor question where he asks one question that could have 43 answers, mm-hmm. but he's looking for one. Mm. So you don't want to even venture an answer.
Don't really go there.
Because you don't want to give the wrong answer.
Right.
No, we started Gravity because we realized that although everybody tacitly believed or confessed? I do this a lot.
Probably either both of those things.
They fessed up to love, like love's important.
They confessed and professed it.
They didn't, there was radical different definitions or understandings of what love meant.
Yeah.
And so part of what Gravity's project has been, has been, and primarily in our coaching and training, is to reassert the primacy and centrality of love.
Yeah.
And to name the things that impede or hinder our living in love faithfully as Jesus did. That is a work of deconstruction.
Yeah.
Naming the assumptions we have about love.
Yeah.
And then holding them up to truth and beauty, goodness, and saying, are these right? Are these true?
Are these true?
Right?
Yeah, because a lot of times, we've talked about this in the past, but a lot of, we make a lot of assumptions about love, which leads us to either, like you said, tacitly acknowledge it, or I think a lot of times just assume that because I'm a Christian, love is important, and what I'm doing is loving. Because, I mean, why else would I be doing these things?
It's just
I'm not living a wantonly selfish life. I'm loving people. That's why I'm a pastor. That's why I, you know, that's why I preach these sermons. That's why I'm trying to give people good advice in my counseling sessions. Of course I'm loving people.
Sometimes when I go out to eat with my family, I find myself being wantonly selfish.
Wantonly selfish?
My kids get wontons, and I just want to eat them.
You grab them.
I want to
grab
hoard a couple of wontons.
Yeah, wantonly selfish. Today, I knew there was a joke in there somewhere.
Today we're talking about probably one of the most formative books in my childhood, which is the book The Giving Tree.
Uh-huh.
And the ways in which I conceived of The Giving Tree as a kid, and I think my family of origin did, and then some of the realizations I've begun to have about The Giving Tree as I've deconstructed love and become more clear about what love is and isn't.
Yes.
So if you love The Giving Tree, if it's near and dear to your heart, if it's your precious,
just skip this episode. Maybe go to the next one.
Listen to this episode.
Or maybe you really need to listen, but keep an open mind.
Yeah, just gird up your loins. What's the above the shoulder metaphor of loins? Gird up your ear holes.
Yeah, I don't know. That you know strikes me as vaguely offensive for some reason. I don't know why. Fasten your headphones to your head.
Yeah, strap it on.
Strap them
on.
I
feel like the epithet on my tombstone will say vaguely offensive.
Vaguely offensive. But we could never figure out why, so we didn't know what to challenge him on.
Yeah. We're going to talk about the Giving Tree today and just some things we're learning about love before we do that.
No, that's it, I think.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah.
No announcements?
Well, we don't really have...
Then we should get out. We should get out.
We're always starting new Gravity Leadership cohorts, so...
We are in the process of starting two. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so hit us up.
Hit us up. If you're interested, there's more information in the show notes, as always.
Mm-hmm.
Let's listen to this episode about love.
Yeah, get ready. We're practicing. This is the practitioner podcast.
Yeah, the practice podcast.
We're in Lansing.
Little known fact.
We're in Lansing, Michigan right now. In a basement, in a bunker.
Yeah. We're doing this one on the practitioner podcast?
Undisclosed location. We don't have to do practitioner. This could go out to everybody. I don't care. I don't care who cares about this.
All right.
We'll decide later. And if you are hearing this and you're not a practitioner and you like this... It may be a sign that
you're supposed to become one.
A patron, you know, a supporter. Yeah. Yep. If you don't like it, then just delete it.
Turn it off.
But I'm staring. So it's just before lunch. We're going to record this, and then we're going to go to get some barbecue at this place, which is like my top five foods, like barbecue, like really good barbecue.
Good stuff.
But this barbecue joint is called the Gravity Smokehouse and Barbecue. It's meant to be, Ben.
Yeah, we kind of have to go. We'll take a picture. We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. Oh. So this is going to be the shortest podcast ever because my mouth is watering.
All right. It gets good ratings, too. So it's not just because it's Gravity, but it gets 4.6 stars. So
is this our podcast on iTunes, or is this the barbecue joint?
No. I think our podcast gets more than 4.6. the barbecue joint gets good ratings.
Well, the barbecue joint sounds good, but we had a number of podcast episodes sort of in the queue. We've been thinking about, they've been slow. We've been smoking these for a long time. And we wanted to get to one today.
It's gonna make yourself hungrier.
One of the things we talk about a lot is love. And often we hear people sort of tacitly affirm how important love is. But what comes out, if you dig or scratch it all below the surface, is we have to really be careful how we define love. Like, let's get really specific. I had a friend the other day who said right now he was on the social medias, as they call
them. I've heard of that.
And that he was describing the conflation that people are making where they are conflating God is love with love is God.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it was cranking him up a bit. And I see the point here, right? So we don't start with our conception of love and ascribe that to God or make a God out of our conception of love. But the only reason we know what the heck love is because God is love and he's been revealed in Jesus Christ.
That's in the Bible. That's 1 John, right?
I'm just slinging scripture like it's an all-you-can-eat.
Like it's a youth
scripture
group.
Buffet.
Yeah.
Like I'm a youth pastor again. I should have had a PowerPoint flashback. I was using PowerPoint. I was addicted to PowerPoint as a youth pastor.
Were you?
And now I can't remember the last time I used PowerPoint. Now don't get me started on ProPresenter, because that right there, that's where it's at. All right. So so we wanted to chat through. Let me chat through one of, this was shocking for me. I want to tell you how love got deconstructed for me, and it almost ruined me. It did, Ben.
Yeah.
I'm still here, though.
Yeah, yeah. Here you are.
Here I am.
You did okay.
I'm a survivor.
Hi, Matt.
Thanks. One of my favorite books growing up was the book The Giving Tree. Mm. You remember that book, Ben?
Yeah, Shel Silverstein. Yes. Silverstein? Yeah. Silverstein. Right, The Giving Tree. It's about a little boy and a tree. A tree who keeps giving to the little boy.
Yeah,
right?
I wonder if there's anybody that hasn't read this book or doesn't know the story.
There might be.
But essentially, the story is there's a tree that this little boy plays around. He swings on the swing, and that is attached to a branch, and he climbs up the tree, and he picks apples out of the tree and eats the apples. And when it gets hot, he sits in the cool, the shade of the tree. And the tree is personified, so the tree appreciates and enjoys the company of the child, and the child enjoys all the things the tree offers him. But the story then is about how this child gets older, and once the child gets older, the child no longer wants to swing and play and eat and enjoy the shade. Now the boy wants other things apart from the tree.
Yeah.
That he asks if he can use the tree for.
Right. Like what?
Like branches to build a house. Uh-huh. Like apples to sell to make money, like a trunk to build a boat, which is interesting. Yeah. I'm kind of impressed by how utilitarian this boy is. You know, he can just like build a boat out of a tree trunk. I think if I tried to do that, I would sink. Yeah. Anyway, so what happens is the tree keeps saying yes to the boy. The tree keeps giving apples and then branches and then the trunk. And by the end of the book, the tree is just a stump. Mm. And the end of the book is the little boy has become a young man, has become a grown man, has become an old man. And the old man comes back to the tree, and the tree apologizes. Mm. There's nothing left of me for you to use. Mm. And the old man says, it's okay, I don't need anything, I just need a place to sit. And so the stump, which was the tree, says, well, you can sit here. So the book ends with
the old man
sitting on the stump of the tree, and the tree was happy. So the book pivots around a relationship that the tree wants to have with this boy, this man, and how in the beginning there was kind of this relationship of mutuality, perhaps mutual enjoyment. And then in the middle, the tree has to give away what the tree is in order to make the boy happy, but there isn't mutuality. The boy's sort of using the tree to get what he wants that he thinks will make him happy.
Right.
And then by the end of the story, the old man, he doesn't come back with all the money and the house and the boat that he'd used the tree for. He comes back sort of old and tired and there's nothing he has. And then the tree... And then he sits on the tree, and the tree and the boy are connected again, or together again, and
yes.
He's happy.
Okay, so that's the story.
That's the giving tree. I actually told it sort of, I'm sort of tipping my hand, Ben.
You did, yeah. You used the word use a lot.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know what else.
So you're tipping your hand because this story has been held up, right, as an exemplar of what love looks like. Right?
Yeah.
The tree's activity is what love looks like.
Yeah. So I actually heard, do you remember Brennan Manning?
Mm-hmm.
He wrote Abba's Child and a couple other...
Ragamuffin Gospel.
He was hugely influential
for me.
He was a Roman Catholic priest that stopped being a priest, but I think remained Roman Catholic, but a lot of Protestants have read him.
Yeah.
And I watched him speak once, and he told the story that he was a childhood friend of Shel Silverstein. And Brennan Manning got in a conversation with Shel, who was, I think, Jewish, about what Jesus was like. And Brennan said Shel Silverstein wrote this book as a parable of what Jesus was like. Now, I don't know if that's true.
Hmm.
Brennan Manning has a reputation for being a teller of tall tales.
Does he?
He spins the half-true yarns a lot. Yeah. So I don't know if it's true or not, but I think this is a common perception. I grew up reading this book thinking the tree is a Christ figure that loves this boy to the uttermost, loves him to the end.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
But I want to maybe, I'm going to ruin some childhood fantasies here, including my own. Yeah. It was a crazy day when I reread that story and saw that I don't think this is a Christ-centered picture of what love is.
Yeah. So it was a crazy day.
Well, it was just harrowing, if you will. Because I had just assumed that for so long, and it had become kind of this parable that, you know, would make me cry. You know, I mean, read that book and you cry a little bit.
Yeah.
You know?
It seems very...
It's moving.
Sacrificial.
It's moving.
Of the tree.
Yeah. But there's some elements in here that I would call are not... There's a relationship that I would not describe as loving here.
Yeah. So this is interesting, Matt, because I think what you're describing is what needs to happen oftentimes for people to really understand what it means that God is love, is you do have to deconstruct your current notions of love.
Yeah.
Instead of assuming that they're true.
Yeah.
You know, to just say like, oh, God is love. Does that make sense? But basically you're thinking like, does what I think about love match what I think about God?
Yes.
And if it's close enough, then you can affirm that. Mm-hmm. And if not, then you want to say something like, yeah, but he also, you know, punishes sin and he's kind of wrathful, right? You know what I mean? You kind of want to qualify it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is an important element of this, is learning how to deconstruct your notions of love. Because a lot of us have these kinds of things embedded in our consciousness, especially stuff we read as kids that was moving for us as kids.
Yeah.
We've got these things embedded in our consciousness that we don't even realize are there.
No, unreflected upon.
Sorry. Unreflected upon, yeah. So it's like you're deconstructing love, essentially.
So let me ruin this book for you.
Yep, here we go.
Okay.
So why is it not, Matt, tell us, why is it not loving for what the tree does for the boy?
Because love involves two parties. Mm. And the boy never demonstrates that he wants, that he sees happiness with the tree, for the tree. The boy simply uses the tree for pleasure. And then moves on. So at every stage, the boy is enjoying what the tree can do for him rather than enjoying the tree for the tree. Now, you kind of get a picture of that in the beginning because the boy's playing and swinging and eating and climbing and resting. And you kind of get a picture of that at the end, right, where he's just sitting. Although there is kind of this macabre, sort of depressing picture of this man who's spent his whole life chasing happiness and now is exhausted and he's resting on the stump of every attempt to find happiness in things. Mm. He's resting on the tree is, you know, stumps are like dead trees.
Right.
So he's resting on his legacy of using and destroying sacrificial love to try to find happiness. Well, not sacrificial love. Resources.
Yeah. So there's a parody of love here then.
I think so.
And this shows up in people as well, right? Where I mean, it's not just so. Yeah, a lot of thoughts crashing into my head at the same time. So it's a parody of love because only one party is called to sacrifice. Only one party is called to give. And what they end up giving is something essential of themselves. This is the tree. For the pleasure of the other, but outside of the relationship.
Yeah.
You know?
And so I think most people get that, right? Most people get, the boy's pretty rotten to this tree.
Right.
But most people then put the tree on a pedestal of, this is how God loves us.
Even when we're rotten to him.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And I do want to say that like there is at the heart of God is a self-giving, other-centered, kenotic, cross-shaped love. So like we affirm that. But that love has, I think, that love isn't all yes. That love is yes and no. And that love grows and accommodates and shifts depending upon where we are. So let me give an example here. In the book, the tree never challenges how the boy defines happiness or offers him a different story. She just, the tree just capitulates to the boy's desires.
As they stand.
As they
stand. I want a boat. Fine, here you go. Yeah.
Yes. So the tree then never calls the boy's desires into maturity, shaping, questioning, a deeper commitment to the tree. Yeah. Rather, the tree exists to fulfill the desires of the boy.
Yeah.
The tree is the American dream machine.
That's right. I have a desire. And so the picture of love is the unfettered fulfillment of whatever my heart desires.
And it's loving, and I'll know what love is if I find somebody who will enable me to do that.
Yes. Yeah. That's how I'll know.
I think that's something desperately wrong with our notion of love.
Yeah.
And it wreaks havoc on relationships and commitments we have.
Yeah. So I'm struck by this, Matt, because I think this is probably what's legitimately in the back of people. When people say, well, we got to balance God's love and God's wrath. When people say that, it seems to me what they're doing is importing this definition of love, that it's just this like, here, have
permissive,
whatever you want.
Enabling, permissive,
yeah. And so
fulfillment of desire.
They're like instinctively bucking against that, rightfully.
Yes.
But they're just assuming that definition of love and saying, I know how to do that. I know how to solve this instinctive bucking against that I feel, is we balance God's love, which is his permissiveness, with God's wrath, which is his anger.
Yeah.
Which is like, none of that. The New Testament doesn't talk about love like that.
No. And so talking about love like that is actually capitulating to a cultural understanding of love that isn't Christ-centered.
Yeah.
So let's stop talking about love like that.
Yeah.
Right?
We're not balancing love and truth or love and wrath.
No. Nope.
That's not it.
That's not it. So,
and anytime we have the instinct to do that, the step to take is to go back and say, what am I assuming about love that makes me think it needs to be balanced with anything? Right?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Totally.
What am I assuming about it? Because the New Testament doesn't balance love with anything.
Yeah.
It just says God is love.
Yeah. Yes.
Anyway.
You're right, Ben.
Okay.
Preach.
All right. I'm done preaching. Go ahead.
Okay.
You got more?
So the first thing is the tree never challenges what the boy desires.
Yeah.
Or how the boy defines happiness. The tree just capitulates what the boy desires. And I want to say that is not love, full stop.
Yes.
Number two, the tree... If you notice this, every time the boy comes back and he's older, the tree greets the boy. Do you know? Remember how the tree greets the boy every time he comes back?
No, I don't.
The tree goes, oh, hey, boy, come climb in my branches and swing and rest in my shade and eat my apples.
Mm-hmm.
So the tree only relates to an 8-year-old boy, even when the man before him is grown.
Yeah.
So the tree refuses to let go of who the boy was.
Yeah, the tree has a preferred vision of the boy.
The tree is locked into this time and place that the tree is nostalgic for, sentimental for, misses probably, right? I mean, it's clear that the tree longs to have the relationship it used to have with the boy.
Right.
But, you know, there aren't many grown men who climb trees, and unless your name's Zacchaeus.
Not with
and,
this back.
And eat apples, right? So the tree then refuses to grow with the boy.
Yeah.
And so doing doesn't actually meet the man where he is, but relates to the man in some preferred, sentimentalized, nostalgic past.
Yeah. So love deals in reality.
Love deals with what is.
Yep.
In the rugged reality, even when the reality isn't what you want.
Right. So getting back to those desires, so the false vision of love capitulates to the desire, assuming it's true, but this more strong, robust vision of love, it has the wherewithal to tell the truth about desire, to name it, not necessarily capitulate to it, but, you know, if it's not loving to say yes, then it might be loving to say no. And also then, a true vision of love also deals with people as they are, not as we would like them to be.
Yeah. So just to hit pause on this, we're in Lansing to do a parenting workshop. We do a parenting workshop in Grace and Truth. By the way, Grace and Truth is how we name and define the love that is revealed in Jesus Christ. I've got the situation with my son, who's 11, and it's winter in the Midwest.
Yep.
And rational, sane people wear coats in the winter because it's cold.
The kids don't. Well, no kids. My kids don't wear coats.
I'm fixing to get there.
Okay, right.
Okay, so like when my son was three,
uh-huh.
he didn't, I just put him in a coat. I put him in a coat and a hat and gloves.
You don't get a choice here.
No, but anyway, like he didn't even question it. Like, why am I wearing a coat? It's cold outside. Oh, okay, yeah, of course we wear a coat, right? It's a three-year-old's like, okay, yeah, I'll just wear a coat. But like my son's 11 now, and it's like 27 degrees, and he's wearing pants and a long sleeve shirt. And that's it. And I'm like, son, it's cold outside.
Mm-hmm.
I know. Son, you're gonna be at recess and you're going to be outside for 30 minutes today and it's going to be freezing. I know.
Yeah.
Right? Now, my temptation is to treat him like a three-year-old.
Here.
Hold him. I'm going to hold him down,
yep.
put my knee on his chest, and like...
Get your coat on.
Yeah, and like squeeze a coat on him.
Yep.
Right? But what
a three-year-old's coat, though? Just kidding.
Maybe that's the problem. Maybe that's why he doesn't want to wear it. It doesn't fit very well.
Dad, it's too tight. Why do you do this?
Fat kid in a little coat. So I'm learning. I have to grow with my son.
Yeah.
And unless I empower him to make some bad decisions in a limited, safe, boundaried way.
Right. He won't freeze to death. He'll just be cold at recess.
He'll just be cold at recess. And if he gets sick, then, you know, I can, as I feed him chicken noodle soup, I can give him the shaming eyes that we all like so much.
I'm not going to say anything.
But you know. No, so like, I, in order to love my son, I have to grow with him and empower him and even let him make some decisions I wouldn't.
Yeah.
I can't continually relate to him as though he's the same person because he's not.
Mm-hmm.
This is why so many marriages get in trouble.
Yeah.
Too. We marry somebody and we demand that they always want to climb our branches and pick apples and swing from our branches.
Yeah.
You know? But what happens is people change.
Yeah.
People grow.
Yeah.
Stanley Hauerwas has this really infuriating but also amazing line about marriage. He says, he's talking about soulmates, and he says, nobody marries their soulmate.
Yeah.
He said, even if you think you marry your soulmate,
that's not who they are.
That's not who they are.
Yeah.
Because most people don't know who they are when they get married.
Yeah.
And even if you do know who you are and your spouse knows who they are when you get married, if you're one of the rare people that has like a fully actualized, cognizant, rash, like, you know, like no illusion self, just wait because you'll change.
Yeah.
Right. You'll change. And then, so what I'm realizing in my marriage is, my wife and I have gone through this, I know you and Deb have too, is my wife isn't the person I married 20 years ago.
Right.
I'm not the person who married my wife 20 years ago.
Right.
And so I can continually relate to her as though she's the same person she was when she was 23.
Yeah. Or wish or try to make her into that.
Or just allow that to be sort of the reason why I'm no longer compatible.
Yeah, yeah. We're not in love anymore because we're not the same people. So let's just, you know, let's leave.
Yeah.
Yeah. So divorces happen because of this, essentially.
Right. But covenants are these strong, boundaried commitments where we learn how to grow and change as people grow and change, so that our love has to mature.
Yeah,
we can't stay locked in one. We can't figure out how to love somebody one time and just do that. So whether you're married, whether you're a parent, or whether you're a pastor, to love like Jesus means you're accommodating and condescending to where people are, meeting them where they're at a great cost to yourself, yes, but you're not demanding people don't change.
Yeah. You're accepting them where they're at. You are at least accepting that this is the person that I'm talking to.
Yes.
This is the church I have.
Yes.
I have to pastor. This has been a huge lesson for me, is like, I can't make my church into the ideal church. I have to pastor the church I have.
Yes.
You know? And this is what it is right now.
Bonhoeffer called that the wish dream of community.
Yeah.
He said the only thing that'll kill biblical Christ-centered community is you relating to a wish dream of what that community should be,
yes,
rather than dealing with what it is.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Gravity Leadership Academy, our 10-month online training intensive for Christian leaders who want to root their life and leadership in God's love and bring lasting transformation to their culture. In Gravity Leadership Academy, you'll learn the real-life practicalities of how to notice God's presence and activity in and around you so you can participate more fully in God's life and mission and open up space for those around you to do so too. We've worked really hard to make this training in missional leadership practical and doable. To find out more about Gravity Leadership Academy, visit gravityleadership.com/academy.
But he's saying the same thing that I'm trying to say about the giving tree, which is the tree doesn't let the boy grow and relate to the boy where he is.
Yes.
But rather, the tree stays locked in one stage of the relationship and demands that the boy calls the boy back to that.
Yeah.
Right? The third thing I would say is that, so the first thing is the tree just
capitulates to the boy's desires.
Yes. The second thing is the tree refuses to let the boy get older.
Yes.
The third thing is that the only relationship the boy wants with the tree, I would say, even potentially as a young boy and an old man, but let's take those off the table because I think those are debatable, in the middle of his life, is that the boy wants to use the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And the tree lets himself be used or herself be used.
Yeah. This is like the kid who comes home, but he only just wants, like after college or whatever, and, you know, gets fired from his job. He just wants money from his parents.
Yep. Just money. Just place to live in money. And I don't want any commitments, I don't want any responsibilities.
Yeah.
Don't make any demands on me.
Yeah.
Just feed me and give me a place to live and stay out of my way.
Right. And according to the giving tree, the loving sacrificial thing would be to do all of that.
To accommodate that.
To accommodate that, right.
Yeah,
right.
And I would just say that love doesn't use people.
Yeah.
Love also resists enabling people using me.
Yeah.
Because we know that's not good for me.
Yeah.
And that's not good for you.
Yeah. That's not how relationships are meant to function.
If I let you use me and you think that that's good, that's a severely damaging thing I'm doing to you.
Yes. Yeah. So it can be extremely, it's very loving to say no, you know, to set boundaries, essentially.
Yeah,
I won't be treated that way. That's not selfish. It's loving.
Yeah.
To say I won't be treated that way.
Yeah.
I'm only concerned about myself, but because I am concerned about you.
Yeah.
I don't want to enable you to continue to do this to me or to anybody.
Right.
But, yeah.
So then can I just share maybe that's deconstructing the giving tree.
Mm-hmm.
Those are some of the things I saw in it as I began to spend time with Jesus and watch and notice how Jesus loved people.
That's good.
In the contrast between Jesus and the giving tree.
Yeah. So I think that's important to say, like this different definition of love that challenges the giving tree, doesn't just sort of come out of thin air or out of like psychology textbooks. Like this is spending time with Jesus and noticing how he loves. So this is basically applying that 1 John principle about love. It's like, how do we know what love is? Well, we know what love is because God loved us. Well, how did God love us? God sent his son. And Jesus says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And so we look at Jesus in the Gospels, and what we see him doing is what love does.
Yes.
And so that's I think, the picture. That's an important thing to say. Like all this stuff we're asserting about love, it's really rooted in the life of Jesus.
Yes. Yeah. So then maybe we can make some proactive statements about love.
Yes.
Here to close out. So the love we see revealed in Jesus says yes, which is what the giving tree does the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
But love also says no.
Yeah.
So love is saying yes and no, learning to say both. It's crucial.
Yeah.
That we have room in our conception and embodiment of love to say no.
Yeah. And that demands wisdom. It demands wisdom and some distance from, you know what I mean? Like we have to own, and I mean, to quote a previous episode, we have to own and name our kairoses if we're going to actually be able to love, because we have to have some distance from our own stuff.
Yes.
In order to make a wise, what's yes and what's no? Well, wisdom can show you.
Yes. Okay. Number two, and this is, we see this in Jesus, love doesn't assume that another's happiness exists in them getting all their desires met.
Right.
So love seeks the good of another.
Yes.
But love doesn't assume that that good is getting every desire met.
Yeah. And I'm thinking of a Billie Eilish song.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it because we're in a music studio right now?
Yeah, it might be. There's a new song that she has out that I really like. And she says something like this. She says, I had a dream. I got everything I wanted. And then I think a little bit later, there's one more line in there that I don't know. I had a dream. I got everything I wanted. I think it was a nightmare is the next line. For anyone who might care. It's a great little song.
So, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. So love is learning to say yes and no.
Yes
love,
and no.
Love that's revealed in Jesus understands that the good of another isn't giving them or enabling them to get everything they want.
Yes.
Desire is a meeting place for God. God wants to shape our desires, not just meet them. He wants to reveal our desires. He doesn't just want to fulfill them.
Yes.
Number three, love learns to let go and empower and adapt.
And adapt?
Adapt. Yeah. So then love doesn't enable people. Love empowers people. Yeah. So like with my son, here's what I'm learning to do. I'm learning not to try to control his choice not to wear a coat. It's not a choice I'd make. I don't think it's wise. But I'm learning to empower him to say, you can make this decision and you will also take responsibility for the consequences of this decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's love.
Mm-hmm.
That love is you are empowered to use your agency to do something that I wouldn't do for you.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I won't then drive your coat to the school today
right.
when you're cold at recess.
Right.
I also will... probably need to bring some consequence if there's another repercussion of you being cold at recess. I probably will not shield you from those consequences.
Right, right.
Like it's good for you to experience my choices matter.
Yeah.
My decisions bring results that I may not like, and I need to account for how I use my agency.
That's not being mean to somebody. That's empowering them. That's empowering them to feel the results of your choices is extremely empowering, because then for Deacon, his problem can be his relationship to his coat rather than dad.
Yeah.
Dad's always on me about my coat.
No.
And that allows him to not deal with the consequences of his choices, because his problem is just dad now.
Yes. And if I could just put a caveat here, a consequence for your choice is different than a punishment for your choice.
Yes, absolutely. That's really good.
So I'm not going to say, hey, you have to wear your coat. Otherwise, I'll ground you for a week.
Right. That's a punishment.
That's a punishment because you're disobeying me.
Right. Right.
Right.
A consequence for not wearing your coat is being cold at recess.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so then we have conversations outside of these times where there's rules. So for instance, he can't watch certain shows. I won't let him watch most PG-13 movies. And all his friends are watching like Stranger Things and like other shows that I'm just like, how could you possibly, my 11-year-old, I need to take care of his imagination.
Yeah, yeah.
But we talk often about, okay, when I say no to you, I don't want to protect you from every bad thing and every bad choice. I said, because when you get to be in college and I'm no longer there with rules or protection, and you're, for the first time in your life, having to make choices on your own without any understanding of how to do that or why you would make a choice or what the consequences, it's like, this is why so many Christian kids, I think,
go to college, and they just lose their minds.
Yeah.
It's the first time in their life they can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And they just do it all. Yeah. It's rum springa.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm going to try it. I'm going to drink it every fountain of Satan's, you know, soda
right.
stand.
Right. Because they've, yeah, the only reason they've been good this whole time is because there's been punishments for being bad. You know what I mean?
Like somebody's watching. You know?
Right. Or somebody's watching. And so they've carried with them this belief that my happiness is getting what I want and I can't do it right now because dad and mom are my problem.
Yes. So then, I'm not saying this to critique anybody's way of parenting. I'm just saying this to say, like, I have conversation with Deacon. Deacon, I love you, which means I want you to grow in wisdom, which means in under controlled, safe circumstances, you're able to employ your agency in ways that I wouldn't.
Yeah.
But you have to live with the consequences of it because the consequences of bad choices are a great tutor of how of why not to make bad choices, right?
Yeah.
And so love then doesn't shield people from the consequences of their actions.
Yes.
All right. Number four.
We got number four?
What typically I think people hold up the tree as a paragon for is sacrificial love.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about what dying to self is and isn't.
Mm.
So I grew up in a family system that equated dying to self as never trusting what you want or need to other people. So if I need something or I want something, it's virtuous to not
sublimate it,
to just kill it, suffocate it. Deny it, to because it's selfish to
That's
ask
selfish.
For what you want. It's self-centered to ask for what you need. It's presumptuous to be forthright with your opinion.
Yeah, it sounds like an unhealthy Enneagram too.
Say more. Yeah, say more about that.
Yeah. So if you're familiar with the Enneagram, the two is the helper, but what one of the features of unhealthy. Too. So every Enneagram type has a range of health to unhealthy, you know, healthy versus unhealthy. And in the unhealthy ranges, twos are completely unable to own and name what they want because their whole identity has been they've carved out an identity for themselves around this idea that I am the self-sacrificial one. I am here to help you. I don't have needs. I'm here to help you with your needs.
Yes.
And so when they have a need, it's like a crisis, and they're actually trying to get their needs met by serving you and serving you and serving you and serving you, hoping that you will, without them having to say it, that they want something, that you will reciprocate and help them.
Yes.
It rarely happens.
This is my family system.
Mm.
This is probably the dominant religious system I grew up in.
Yeah.
So that what happens is everybody has a veneer of piety.
Yeah.
But underneath, what happens is people are living distanced from their hearts.
Mm-hmm.
They're breeding resentment and condemnation and anger because no one cares for me.
Yeah.
They shame themselves and have self-loathing for the fact that they actually have needs and wants.
Yeah.
And many of them are legitimate, right?
Right.
And then there's also this persecution complex that erupts because I'm the martyr. I'm the one doing everything.
Yeah.
If only people could recognize and appreciate how much I'm dying to myself in order to love other people.
Mm-hmm.
Does nobody see how Christ-like I am? Like, you know what I'm saying? So there's this, and I just, I'm trying not to be glib about this. Maybe some of you live like this. Maybe some of you are recognizing for the first time this is you, there's grace for that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying, I want to contend that that isn't what Jesus was talking about when he talked about dying to self.
Yeah. Doesn't mean being a martyr, a victim, a doormat.
Right. So then what would dying to self look like for the tree? Well, the first thing is the tree longs for the boy to be who he was when he was young.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we die to is like not giving other people freedom. You know, not releasing people to grow and change.
Yeah.
We want to hold on to people and keep them where they are and don't ever grow up or don't ever change. You know, this is kind of the thing we write in high school yearbooks, don't ever change. I'm so glad that that wish was unfulfilled in my life.
But it was a hot mess in high school.
A hot mess, right? So that's one of the things. The other thing that seems like the tree, like death for the tree, would to be to offer a new vision of flourishing to the boy.
Yeah.
That would be death for the tree. That's the last thing the tree wants to do. Yeah. Apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think this is where, like, thinking about that unhealthy family system you talked about, I think that helps us here, because death, like, there's a false self that's being cultivated in all of this so-called sacrificial giving, right?
Yeah.
And that's what you're dying to. You're dying to this vision of yourself as the one who's always so Christ-like, the one who is always giving, the one who is always, you know, mm-hmm. to die to that would mean to say something like, I really want something. I really want this. I really, you know. So for the tree to die to that desire would be to probably say something like that to the boy. I wish this could be the case, you know?
Yes.
But then also to let the boy be who he is.
Something like, I miss spending time with you the way we used to.
Yeah.
And now you only show up when you need something from me. And I'm tempted to just give it to you because I want you to be happy and I want that connection we used to have.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to give it to you.
Yes.
Because the only relationship I experience with you is you coming to me when you need to use me.
Yeah.
That would be an incredible death for the tree.
Yeah.
To say that.
Yeah. Or an unhealthy Enneagram too. Anyway. It would be. It would be an incredible death. Yeah, I was reminded of a quote from an Enneagram 2 I heard one time that was talking about their kids were all, they were becoming empty nesters, she and her husband. Kids were all moving off to college, and she said, I realized that the thing that terrified me the most is that now that my kids don't need me, are they going to want me?
Yes.
And death to self for somebody who fears that is to just own and name that. You know what I mean? Just to say that,
yeah.
To own and name it, and not to try to make your kids need you so that they still want you. You know what I mean?
Passive-aggressive manipulation.
Right, but to give them the freedom to perhaps not want you. You know what I mean? Like that might be the case. You know, your kids may choose that.
Yes.
And they may not call as much as you want, but love or death to self is allowing that to be the case, while maybe appropriately speaking to the issue.
Yes.
You know, in the way that you talked about.
Yes. So then death to self isn't becoming a passive doormat for people to walk over.
Yeah.
I think there's probably a whole podcast to do on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
because that's used by leaders sometimes to get people to try to control people.
Yes. It's a weapon.
Extremely
harmful. You just got to die here, man.
You just got to die to yourself.
You got to die to yourself. Anybody... Yeah, when Jesus talks about dying to self, taking up your cross and follow me, he's asking people to repent of a socio-political, national, religious vision that would make Jesus the antithesis of who he is.
Yeah, right.
So he's saying, die to this vision of power that will... that is what's wrong with the world, and take up the instrument of that domination, shaming, and control. Take it up.
Uh-huh.
Submit to it so that the power of it's undone in your life.
Yes.
That's what he's saying when he says die to self.
And he's not saying take up your cross and die for me. He's saying take up your cross with me. I mean, he's the one who took up his cross
and
shows us how to
do it. If anybody would come after me, if anyone wants to follow me.
Yeah, you do what I do, which is we go to the cross.
Right.
Anyway.
Right. So maybe to close out here, the last thing I'd say just about a positive vision of love is that, and I mentioned this already, but like love offers people truth, vision for stepping into a new area of life that's better, healthier, holier, more flourishing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So love then offers non-coercively, I may add, an invitation into a deeper relationship with you and a greater flourishing in reality.
Yeah. Yeah. the truest thing about someone that you can say is usually not what you see that's wrong with them. So the truth you offer is possibility.
Yeah.
The truth you offer is identity,
yeah,
you know, in Christ.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily always... Anyway, sometimes I think that's why we're afraid of
yes.
telling the truth, is
yes.
the only truth I can think of is what annoys me about you right now or
yes.
whatever.
Yes, right,
know?
Right.
But there's more to it than just what's wrong.
So then maybe to close, how this is working out with my daughter right now.
Okay.
She's 8,
mm-hmm.
and she doesn't really want to spend time with me on my terms.
Yeah. What are your terms? What do you mean by that?
Thank you for asking, Ben. My terms would be like when she wakes up in the morning, she would come downstairs and sit on my lap and snuggle with me.
Yeah.
And she would tell me she loves me. And I would tell her I love her.
Yeah.
And she'd give me a kiss. And there'd be like 2 minutes of real nice, intimate connection. Uh-huh. And then she'd leave me alone to read.
Great. Okay. So that's your terms.
And then when I would ask her questions during the day and talk to her, she would appreciate that I'm
interested in her life.
And yeah. that I'm interested in her life or mm-hmm. engaging her. And she would talk back to me. She would look me in the eye and respond, uh-huh. and then yeah. maybe she would ask me questions, and I could help her with my vast array of facts and data and experience that I have.
Yeah, because you read all morning. You've got all kinds of information now that you can give her.
I read and I know stuff. This is the relationship okay. I'd like with my daughter.
Right. So that's your terms.
Absolutely none of that happens.
Okay. She doesn't do that.
She doesn't want to snuggle with me because in the morning I stink.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, what she means by that, I think, is that, like, you know, there's just kind of this general, you kind of have a general bed funk when you get up, you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
you haven't brushed your teeth all night.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes there's a lower wind in operation.
Yeah.
You know, there's just a cacophony of things. And my daughter is extremely conscious of things that are gross,
mm-hmm.
things that are beautiful. And so when I shower and put on cologne and I'm looking, you know, put on my best clothes, she is way more wanting to like touch me and be with me mm-hmm. than when I get up in my PJs.
Yeah. So she doesn't want to cuddle.
She doesn't really talk to me.
It's so funny to hear
Kinda.
You say that.
Like I'll ask her a question and she just won't respond
mm-hmm.
or I'll make a comment and she will like kind of dart her eyes away. Like there's just like dodgy weird things that go on right now mm-hmm. with her. But she signals to me in other ways how she wants our relationship to be.
Mm-hmm.
So she'll write me notes and give me gifts. And she will, after not wanting to be with me all day, come up to me after dinner
mm-hmm.
when I'm just exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
Like exhausted. And she will grab my shirt mm-hmm. and pull me close to her and go, "I need attention." And what that signals, what that means is you can't talk to anyone else.
Uh-huh.
You can't look away from my eyes.
Uh-huh.
You have to be touching me the whole time.
Uh-huh.
And it probably has to be some physical engagement with me
uh-huh.
nonstop until I'm done with you.
Yeah.
Like she gets this like hyper focused, give me attention. And I'm like, that's it. I'm screwed. Like I got no energy.
I cannot do it.
I need to use the restroom or my wife. I don't want to help my wife clean up for dinner. But now like this is it. This is my opportunity.
Right.
Right. And so I like for me right now, I submit to this. We usually wrestle or mm-hmm. dance
mm-hmm.
or I swing her around or I pick her up or we play airplane. It's really physical.
Mm-hmm.
It's physical with her.
Yeah.
And just give her that. And she loves when I give her gifts and write her notes and make her pictures.
Hmm.
Those are the last things I want to do. The absolute last things
yeah,
I want
yeah.
to do. But right now, what it looks like for me to die to myself and
yeah.
love my daughter
yeah.
is to meet her where she's at.
Yeah.
Like to really meet her where she's at.
Yeah.
Without, you know, being a martyr.
Right.
Or demanding she be somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And meeting her where she's at, actually, I've noticed I can call her into conversations that we weren't having otherwise.
Yeah.
I can call her into, she makes eye contact with me. She
yeah.
wants to snuggle.
Yeah.
I can call her into the things I enjoy,
yeah.
but I have to meet her where she is first.
Yeah. In order to, I mean, one of the things we talk about in this parenting workshop is connect before correct. You know, if there is something,
yes.
There's probably plenty of things an 8-year-old, you know, would need to be corrected for. And there's probably a vision for her that you want to call her into. Like when somebody does address you, like, you know, you want to call her into,
yes.
you know, responding, not just capitulate to that,
yes,
you know? But the platform that you have to speak into her life in those ways is based upon your willingness to connect with her in the ways that she is able to connect with you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so if she's 28 and I'm still like, let's play Airplane.
Some of this is age dependent, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, this gets back then maybe to close a loop on the giving tree. Mm-hmm. Like there's a way for me to appreciate this and I'm learning how to appreciate it.
Yeah.
It still feels like a death to me.
Yeah.
Also what it means to love my daughter is not demand that she never grow and change out of this.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. This was such a sweet time, you know, in our lives.
Yeah.
You know,
and then, you know,
you don't want attention anymore. Right. We never wrestle. We never, you know, whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So that's deconstructing the giving tree.
Yep. And love. Hopefully everybody's okay.
Everybody's okay? It's so important. It still is. I still get teary-eyed when I read the book, but I'm learning that Jesus' love is better than the tree's love.
Yeah.
And that it actually, the Jesus love that I'm encountering actually meets and transforms the boy rather than just acquiesces and gets used by the boy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's important too. Like oftentimes we see these things in black and white terms, like everything about the giving tree is awful. But no, there's elements of it. You know what I mean? Like you get teary-eyed when you think about the giving tree.
Yeah.
And there's elements of it that are probably reflective of the love of Christ, but it's not in its totality. And I think that's what's worth thinking about, remembering.
All right. So I'm happy to hear where you think I'm misreading the giving tree. Happy to hear where you think I don't fully understand the giving tree or I need to consider another dynamic of it. So if you'd like to reach out and share that, please email us podcast@gravityleadership.com. Yeah, go love friends at the love of Christ.
See you next time.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Our show is produced by Ben Sternke, Matt Tebby, and Ben Hardman. Aaron Sternke does our mixing and mastering. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com. If you find our podcast helpful, share it with your friends in person and on social media. And don't forget to rate and review us online as well as subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can join our Gravity community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join. And hey, we'd love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment, send us an idea, a recommendation, recipe, whatever. You can email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.